From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Baseball fans in Tampa haven't been able to quite figure out what to do with themselves, aside from those cowbells. Ahead on Only a Game, the big guava goes gaga. Also, a controversial ballot question concerning dog racing goes before Massachusetts voters. And a conversation with Chuck Culpepper, author of Bloody Confused, A Clueless American Sports Writer Seeks Solace in English Soccer. Also ahead, intrepid athletes and superheroes gather in southern England to defy the elements in pursuit of the world crazy golf title.
There's only two things that will stop us playing here. Either there's so much snow on the ground you can't see where the course is, or thunder and lightning. That aside, it can blow what it likes, it can rain as much as it likes, we carry on. We're British.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tonight in Philadelphia, the Phillies will host the Tampa Bay Rays in Game 3 of the World Series. Thursday night's 4-2 Tampa win evened the series at one game apiece and provided the latest chapter in one of the postseason's more intriguing and unexpected stories, the rise to prominence of pitcher David Price, who finished the game for the Rays just as he finished off the Red Sox in the final game of the American League Championship Series. A couple of successful postseason appearances wouldn't be that big a deal if Price had been closing games for the Rays all season, but he didn't join the team until September. Last year, he was playing college ball. Price has delighted Tampa Bay fans, of course, as has their team's happy penchant for manufacturing runs out of walks, stolen bases, and ground balls, as has the mere fact that the Rays, a team you could never before find at the top of the standings unless you turned your newspaper upside down, are even contending for a championship. From member station WUSF in Tampa, Bobby O'Brien reports.
There are a lot of transplants in the Tampa Bay area, new residents with loyalties to other teams. That was evident Saturday night at Tampa's Press Box Sports Bar. Red Sox fans celebrated victory in Game 6, while Rays fans, like Scott Fallon, watched but remained resolute.
You got to keep believing. Can't give up. I mean, they made it this far. They lost, you know, last year. They were one of the worst teams in the majors. So just to get to this point, you know, you got to be grateful that they at least made it to the ALCS. So whatever happens, you know, it's been a great season that they've had, and hopefully they can pull this off.
The Rays did pull it off. On Sunday, they won Game 7, relying on rookie left-hander David Price to get the last four outs. Rays fan John Hoglund waited for that moment for 11 years.
In a World Series, they've come this far. I think that they can take it. I mean, the Phillies are good, but they're nothing that's worse than big, bad Boston. They just beat last year's champs. They just beat the World Series champions, and that's a big step to getting your own.
Compared to the chants and cheers of the sports bar, there was a library-like reverence as fans lined up at St. Petersburg City Hall to get a glimpse of the World Series championship trophy.
There it is, 2 feet tall, it weighs 30 pounds. Those are 30 plaques.
The only disturbance was a news reporter doing a live shot and the click of cameras. St. Petersburg Mayor Rick Baker proudly posed with fans and the trophy.
For 80 years, St. Pete had spring training here, and spring training was a lot of fun, and we really supported spring training. And then for 15, 20 years, we built a baseball stadium, and we worked to get a team, and there were a lot of heartaches along the way, and ups and downs, and all the trials and tribulations we went through to do that. Very difficult process.
Those tribulations didn't stop when St. Petersburg finally won a team. The Rays never had a winning season until this year. Now a city once known for its senior citizens is the home of the youngest baseball team in the majors.
Well, I think a lot of people consider them their brothers, their cousins, their uncles, their sons, their grandkids. I mean, I just think people, and it's a group of players you can relate to. How can you not relate to Evan Longoria or Rocco Baldelli or any of them?
Yeah, go Rays!
Michael Delp is wearing a baseball cap that commemorates the Rays' inaugural season in 1998. He's one of the self-described long-suffering fans.
I've seen him in purple, green, and now blue.
And which color best describes your mood about them?
Oh, well, should be red because I'm happy, bright, cheerful, but I love the new colors, our new logos, and I think the team's going to do great.
At one point, the line to see the trophy was 10 times longer than the line for early voting across the street. Patricia Holloway and her daughters stood in both.
First time voters and first time World Series!
You've got I voted stickers on, so you did the early voting.
That's right. Yes, the early voting. And I also brought my daughters down to early vote. They never did it. And I said, come on, we're going to see some Rays trophies. So here we are.
World Series fever is spreading, as evidenced by the fans' loudest symbol, besides their blue mohawks, the cowbell. The Rays merchandise store at Tropicana Field was sold out of cowbells Tuesday. That's where Jessica Pateau was buying a shirt. She got tickets for the first game of the World Series. She says she paid too much, but she wanted to witness history.
My husband and I have been coming to the Rays since they opened. I've been in the audience when there's been 1,000 people, and we've still been rooting, and so this is very nice, very sweet for the Rays.
She works at All Children's Hospital Foundation and admits to spreading Rays fever among staff and kids at the hospital.
This is helping everybody, not only the kids in the hospital, and they're excited, and they've been hooting and hollering at the TVs, but it helps everybody and the normal citizen to be able to get behind something and root for them, and, you know, it's great for everyday life around, too.
Whether it's the Mohawks, cowbells, or theme song recorded by Kevin Costner and his band Modern West, one thing is certain, Rays fans will be known after this season. For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Major League Soccer's 13th season ends tomorrow, and the playoffs will begin on Thursday. Joining me now to discuss same is Grant Wall, who writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
The New York Red Bulls had a chance on Thursday to qualify for the playoffs, but they were routed 5-2 by Chicago. They still have a chance. A couple of other teams have to cooperate for New York to sneak in. How important is it to MLS to have New York there in the postseason?
Well, it's important because this is a team that originally was supposed to be the flagship franchise of Major League Soccer, and instead has been a sad sack team the whole way through, has never won a trophy. It's unfortunate because there's a lot of good soccer fans in New Jersey and New York, and they've just never really had much of a chance to see good soccer since the start of Major League Soccer.
Last week, we learned that two members of the Red Bulls had tested positive for banned substances, the first such positives to turn up in MLS. How do you feel about the punishments fitting the crimes in the cases of John Conway and Jeff Park?
Well, to be suspended for 10 games and lose a tenth of your salary seems pretty harsh when you look at it on the face of it, especially given the timing of it this late in the season, right around playoff time. But I think it does send a good message, at least, that you know this isn't going to be allowed. This isn't a sport that's established enough as baseball is in this country to come back from any sort of drug stigma, I guess, that has associated itself with baseball that it's been trying to rally from.
New England has been a consistent presence in the finals. They've earned a spot in the 2008 postseason as well, but can the Revolution beat anybody without Steve Ralston, who's been out with a broken leg?
It's going to be really hard. You and I have talked over the years about the bad luck that New England has had in the playoffs. Usually it's been in the championship game the last few years, and Steve Ralston has been a constant positive force for them over the years. And to not have him because of a broken fibula is going to be a real issue for a team that hasn't had as good a season as it has in recent years, and I think may have a little tougher time in the playoffs, having to start out against the Chicago Fire team that I think could do pretty well.
For years, Grant, the Columbus Crew has advertised themselves as the hardest working franchise in pro sports, and they got the hard hat on their logo and everything. This year, the work paid off. Columbus has the league's best record. Can they win their first championship?
I think they can, and Ziggy Schmid, their coach, is a huge reason why. He came in a couple of years ago and struggled his first couple of seasons, but was building a young team that now you look up and down the line, there's some really exciting, good young players, from Chad Marshall to Robbie Rogers. And Guillermo Barros-Goloto is, for me, the MVP of MLS. They're a fun team to watch, and I think they've got a good shot to get to the championship game.
In the Western Conference, Houston finished first. They are no stranger to MLS Cup Finals, of course. Any danger they'll be complacent in this postseason?
I don't think so. I think this is a team that has had so much success in the playoffs. It really is becoming a dynasty in this league, having won the last two championships in Houston. And they're my favorite to win, again. They seem to be peaking at the right time. And I really like the chemistry that's been with this team under Dominic Kinnear, their very good American coach, for the last several years.
The question that's on the minds of star-struck fans of soccer and star-struck fans of fashion and pop culture and tattoos as well concerns David Beckham. Is his somewhat less than excellent adventure with MLS over?
I think it's unlikely to be over. I do think Beckham will be back in 2009 in MLS, but I do think there are some doubts about that now that he appears to be going to AC Milan for an off-season loan to play there to keep fit for the England national team, which apparently he's been told he needs to be if he wants to play for England and have a chance at playing in the 2010 World Cup. But things have gone very poorly on the field for Beckham and the Los Angeles Galaxy ever since he got here. This is a team that's missing the easy-to-make MLS playoffs for the second straight year with Beckham. They went 12 games without a win at one point this season. And I guess the question I have is, despite what he says publicly, does he want to be here? Does he want to be with this team? He's been successful as a celebrity, I think, in this country, and people know who he is. But Beckham has always said that it's about the soccer for him. And the soccer has been a complete fiasco at this point, so we'll have to wait and see how much he really wants to come back for season three.
Grant, the current economic situation notwithstanding, Major League Soccer is talking expansion. Seven cities, three of them in Canada, recently submitted bids for new franchises. Which of those cities seem to you most likely to get teams?
Right now, it looks to me like Montreal is the one team in the Canadian group that has a good stadium plan. Owners, including George Gillette, the guy who owns Liverpool right now, and a real chance for a good rivalry with Toronto, which has been a very complete success story for Major League Soccer since it debuted. The other team that right now I would lean toward is in Miami, where FC Barcelona has hooked up with a Bolivian billionaire. The chance to have FC Barcelona, one of the great brands in international soccer, associated with your league seems like something that the league probably doesn't want to pass up.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and for SportsIllustrated.com. Grant, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Dorothy Peterson is a champion with a problem. She's outlasted nearly all her competition. At the recently concluded Huntsman World Senior Games in Utah, Peterson, 85, won the gold medal in table tennis for her age group. After her triumph, she said she was worried that the only other person in that age group seemed a little frail and might not compete next year. Besides longevity, Peterson's strength is the backspin she puts on her backhand shots. Throughout the winter, she practices at a table tennis club in Harlingen, Texas, but during the rest of the year, she resides in North Mankato, Minnesota, where there is no club. There, Peterson says, she practices against her ageless but fairly predictable home robo-pong machine.
May as well go on, as I did on my own, alone again, naturally. To think that only yesterday...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a disillusioned U.S. sports writer seeks inspiration in English soccer and makes the acquaintance of a blue bear. But first, on November 4th, Massachusetts voters will decide whether to prohibit dog racing in the state. Only a Game's Andrea Shea has our report on the divisive ballot question number 3.
A yes vote on question 3 would shut down the state's 2 commercial greyhound tracks by 2010. There's Wonderland and also Raynham Park, where there's live greyhound racing 6 days a week.
Doc Whiskey is gaining, and here comes the 6. Algebra Doc Whiskey gets up and final yards.
Above the track, in the clubhouse restaurant, Peter Larkin waits at a table for his wife.
I live 2.8 miles from the dog track, but who's counting the distance? I come here probably once or twice a month. It's a lot of fun. Basically, it can be a cheap night out.
But those who want to end greyhound racing say it costs lives by causing injury to dozens of dogs each year. Zoe is a retired greyhound. Her owner, Christine Dorchek, wrote the ballot question known as the Greyhound Protection Act and is co-chair of the Committee to Protect Dogs. Standing over Zoe, Dorchek points to a powerful prop.
This is an example of a racetrack cage. It's the exact dimensions that we have here in Massachusetts. Dogs are kept confined in these cages for 20 hours a day. This is just cruel and inhumane.
She calls it a chicken coop for greyhounds.
It's 34 inches high by 32 inches wide, 42 inches deep. A large male greyhound could not even stand up in this cage.
Dorchek says confinement, possible doping, injuries, and a slew of other concerns have driven her 10-year campaign to outlaw dog racing. She got a similar initiative on the ballot in 2000. It was narrowly defeated. In 2006, Dorchek tried again, but Raynham track owner George Carney blocked it from the ballot in the state's Supreme Judicial Court. He tried again this time around, unsuccessfully. At his track in Raynham, Carney defends dog racing, saying it's tightly regulated by the Massachusetts Racing Commission.
The state police are here on a daily basis. We have state vets that are here. Why would anybody want to abuse the dogs when the ability of the dog to go out and run, that's why they get paid, when they got to run and win to make money? Why would people want to put dogs in the kennel they can't turn around? Why would they want to leave them in there 20 hours a day out of 24 when a dog has got to be kept in condition to run? It's like a human being. Go out and try to run a quarter of a mile if you're overweight or out of shape. The greyhounds, they run naturally. It's the way they're bred. They've been running since before the Egyptians.
State law requires the dogs to be let out 5 times a day, but advocates for the racing ban insist that doesn't happen. The two sides also disagree over injuries. Ban advocates emphasize the number and brutality of breaks on the tracks. Industry representatives say the injury rate is low. Last year, Raynham Park hosted just over 5,900 races and reported 91 injuries to the State Racing Commission. Adoption rates and euthanasia numbers are also in dispute. While the debate is foggy with rhetoric, most Massachusetts animal shelters and veterinarians want to end dog racing.
They have to run, they need the vitamins, they need to be taken care of well, and they have to be happy.
Joyce Smith has run a kennel at Raynham Park for 10 years. Her father worked with greyhounds, too. As she sits in the track's adoption center, Off Track Pets, she details the racing dog's diet.
They'll get a meat and a grain with some type of vegetables.
Cooked meat?
No, they eat it raw.
Greyhounds come in all colors and sizes. Their efficient hearts make them perfect athletes, along with their lean, muscular bodies. But their unique physiology also makes them prone to injury, especially leg breaks, according to Dr. Monica Mansfield, a veterinarian at the Medway Animal Hospital. On this day, Mansfield draws blood from a little dog, not a greyhound, named Puff. But 20 years ago, she worked at an animal clinic near a dog track. She vividly remembers the injured greyhounds that came through there. They didn't just have breaks.
We would see a problem with them where they would have a kidney failure that would result if they had a cut or an injury of some type on the bottom of the foot, and then they would become toxic. And it was unique to greyhounds, and it seemed to be unique to greyhounds on the track.
Mansfield is a member of the Massachusetts Veterinary Medical Association, which hasn't taken an official stance on question three. Mansfield says she plans to vote yes to end dog racing, adding that too many dogs are euthanized in the industry. But MVMA member Dr. Bonnie Smith is on the fence regarding her vote. About 10 years ago, she worked as a vet at a dog track in Connecticut.
Dogs that were euthanized at the track usually had some sort of catastrophic injuries. And we would probably euthanize them for the same reason that somebody might euthanize their own dog.
Regarding the size of the cages, Smith says farm animals and even house pets are often confined and might not get nearly as much attention, nutrition, and exercise as racing greyhounds do. In fact, she says, many appear to like their jobs.
And the racing, and how quickly it is a task to see it as Stacy rushing up now, daring Gobo on the inside, Kaiwa Wild Magic.
Back at Raynham Park, owner George Carney says if voters decide to end dog racing, his human employees will be out of work.
If it gets passed, it's like anything else. We'll do the very best we can to take care of the people that have been here all these years.
Everyone interviewed for this story, even track owner George Carney, acknowledged that dog racing is a dying industry, on its last legs, as it were. No one seems to know exactly how many racetrack employees stand to lose their jobs at Raynham Park. That number is probably about 500. Tracks across the country have been shutting their doors in the wake of competition from casinos, slot machines, and lotteries. But if voters approve question three in Massachusetts, it will be the very first time an active dog track would be closed down by a citizen's vote. For Only a Game, I'm Andrea Shea in Raynham, Massachusetts.
If you'd like to read my reviews of books we've featured on Only a Game or selectively listen to past features and interviews, please visit onlyagame.org. Chuck Culpepper was making a living writing about sports. That made him the envy of millions of fans, whom he no doubt regarded as misguided and wrong-headed. I say this because at the beginning of his new book, Bloody Confused, Culpepper writes of his job, "I had spent a 14-year career immersed in a vat of drivel, banality, and corruption, but especially drivel." Oddly enough, Chuck Culpepper decided that the antidote to the malaise he was suffering as a result of following sports in the United States was to follow a sport somewhere else. The sport was soccer, and the somewhere else was Great Britain, and therein, as they say, lies a tale. Chuck Culpepper joins me now from the BBC's Western House in London to tell that tale. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Could you elaborate on the dissatisfaction you began to feel with your career as a sports writer in the U.S.?
I was at a Super Bowl media day in Tampa, which I write about in the book, the Giants-Ravens Super Bowl, when it really hit me that one day that it was just everything around me was so, I don't know if it, you would say pointless or banal, or everything just sort of crashed into me at that point that, wow, what I do for a living is so terribly meaningless.
What made you decide that soccer in England's premiership would be the antidote to that condition?
It was my personal life that carried me to England. And then after that, I thought, well, if I've really always maintained some sort of curiosity about this great noise that comes from these stadiums over here and what's it like to be in those stadiums. And, you know, I'd seen it on TV in the United States, but I didn't know, you know, where certain clubs even were, who the heroes were of the past, what the history and so on. And so I decided that it would be, if I chose a club and I followed it, like being a child again, except going to the pub all the time. So.
Yeah, well, you write that one of the first things you had to do was find a team for which you could cheer. You ended up choosing Portsmouth. I wonder how you avoided becoming a fan of one of the more popular teams, Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool, or Fulham, the team that has employed all those U.S. players.
You know, they have the big four here, Manchester United, Arsenal, Chelsea, and Liverpool. And I decided that choosing any one of those four would be glomming on to, you know, a big bandwagon and would be unoriginal, I guess you'd say. So I decided to choose someone from the, you know, the great masses beneath those four, and every year there are 20 clubs in the league, so someone from the 16. And then I got fascinated with relegation, which you know is the process where three teams drop from the league into the second division every year, and which is just gripping all season long. It's just this emotional construct that people just dread that they might get relegated if they're teetering around there. So I went to Portsmouth one day when they were sitting, or should I say we, I guess, huh?
Absolutely. Sitting, it's okay with me.
18th and booked for relegation, you know, 6 weeks to the end, absolutely booked. And they made this great rescue, and they won that day. And I had goosebumps the whole match. The noise was incredible. And I thought, you know, if you were the 18th best team in the league in the U.S. and it was near the end of the year, nobody would come. But here was this memorable stadium day that I had had. Then I started to get disappointed. Expectations just build rapidly within you until one day in January, Portsmouth lost at home to Charlton, which had finished 7th the year before, and Portsmouth 17th. We lost to Charlton 1-0, and we were just, you know, the mood was ruined for the evening.
I would like you to read a passage from chapter 13 in your book. The title of the chapter is "The Best Goal in My Admittedly Limited Lifetime," and you describe a goal scored by Portsmouth against Everton by Matthew Taylor from 45 yards out, and then you reflect on the instant in which that goal occurred. So perhaps you could read that for us.
Yeah, this goal took one of the oddest paths that I've ever seen into the goal. It went up in the sky, you know, from 45 yards out, and we all sort of watched, all our heads craned up, you know, to see it go up there, and then we watched it come back down, and there's this moment in the middle where you start to think, I think that's going to drop behind the goalkeeper and into the goal. So so here it was. The instant itself seemed elongated, marvelous, and no surprise, quiet. It might have been that moment of mass inhalation writ large. I'm fairly certain I threw a gasp in there, but I didn't hear it. It's as if time gave you an extra second there so that you could sense 19,528 people realizing something, and maybe 17,000 of them relishing it, while the 2,000 or so visitors find it dreadful. It just stands out among millions of fellow instants that instant. Having lived it, I'd just like to wish everyone peace and happiness and one moment in which they see a soccer ball flying precisely from 45 yards, think little of it at first, lazily monitor its path through the air, notice its descent, and then somewhere while it's still airborne, become instantly certain that it's about to land behind the keeper, but in front of the crossbar and into the net. Why bother with sports? There's your answer.
After you had attended a number of games at Fratton Park and followed Portsmouth around England as well, you got to know some of the team's fans pretty well. Please describe some of them for us, including the Blue Bear.
One day on a train, I heard this guy with an incredible laugh. Trains take on a life of their own, especially soccer trains on a Saturday when people are all talking about soccer. And a few weeks later, I heard the laugh again. And it was the same route going down south to the south coast to near the English Channel to Portsmouth. And here the guy got up and left the car. And I thought, well, the guy with the laugh is leaving. And he took his backpack with him. So I thought he was going to visit somewhere else on the train. But he had gone to the loo. And when he came back, he was dressed as a giant blue bear. And I had thought, I have to meet this guy. And he and his two friends, they adopted me. So for months after that, I often went to pubs and games with them and walked the streets of around Fratton Park with them, with him dressed in that blue bear suit. And it's just, if you ever get the chance in life to walk around town with somebody dressed as a blue bear, I highly recommend it, because children wave at you, eyes widen. It just enhances the day in ways you would never think of.
I'm talking with Chuck Culpepper, author of Bloody Confused, and you're listening to Only a Game. Chuck, you live in London now, which is, of course, home to half a dozen Premiership teams. Portsmouth is as far from London as you can go without getting your feet wet in the English Channel. Are you still a Portsmouth fan?
I'm still a Portsmouth fan. I haven't gotten to the stadium as much. Regular life sort of resumed. We won the FA Cup last year, which is a season-long tournament, and it was a huge deal. There was a parade, first time in 69 years, you know, to win it. And the LA Times wanted me to cover the game, but then they didn't give me a press seat because they were all filled because it's such a big deal there. And I sort of spent it outside the stadium at a pub so I could celebrate with people after it, but I didn't get a ticket. And I sort of felt that was just right in a way because in my second season of fandom, there's this thing that, you know, people lived normal lives and died and never saw, you know. And so I sort of felt that was just right. And I kept thinking of, okay, if I bought a ticket, somebody who's followed them for 35 years and waited for this would, I would be in their seat. Mm. So I felt there's some, I haven't earned it. I haven't endured enough pain yet, you know.
Are you at all worried that once you have followed soccer in England for a while, you'll begin to feel immersed in a vat of drivel, banality, and corruption, but especially drivel?
I do worry about that, yes. And one saving grace is that the way you perceive the sports is different. Let's say the NFL, with its media access and its, you know, player availability, and I spent much of my career in the various different sports, walking around these locker rooms, asking players, you know, tripping on jock straps and orange peels and asking players for their insights into what we had all just seen. And so here they don't do that. The locker rooms are closed. You might have a star player and you might not hear his voice for the entire season. And it makes it different the way you perceive the game. There's almost something maybe a little more alluring about it over here because it's not as accessible. So there's less drivel. I mean, when they speak, there's a barrage of drivel. You can count on that. You're just inundated with less of it as you go through the season. You know, there maybe the captain will come out and answer three questions, but that's about it.
Chuck Culpepper is the author of Bloody Confused, A Clueless American Sports Writer Seeks Solace in English Soccer, published by Broadway Books, and he joined me from the BBC's Western House in London. Chuck, thank you very much for speaking
with me. Thank you so much, Bill. Hello, America.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Having become irritated by the youngsters who kept kicking their football into her yard in Blue Ash, Ohio, Edna Jester, 89, recently took matters into her own hands, meaning that she took the football into her own hands and refused to give it back to the kids. The father of one of the children called the police on Ms. Jester, who was scheduled to appear in court next month on charges of petty theft. If convicted, she could have been sentenced to 6 months in jail and fined up to $1,000. However, the Blue Ash City solicitor decided on Wednesday to drop the charges. Justice or an outrage against same? You decide.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? In your neighborhood? Say, who are the people in your neighborhood? The people that you meet each day.
Oh, hi there, little fella.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Crazy Golf and Crazy Old England. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
In NFL news, the Cleveland Browns organization suspended Kellen Winslow for comments the Browns deemed, quote, unwarranted, inappropriate, and unnecessarily disparaging. What were those comments, and was it fair for the team to characterize them in that way?
Well, Kellen Winslow had been hospitalized with a staff infection and had mentioned that to his knowledge, Cleveland had had several other staff infections among its injured players, which the team had asked him to cover up. The general manager, a guy named Phil Savage, who talks like every other corporate drone you've ever had, most of them infesting sports these days, said, "The Browns are bigger than one person. We can't and won't allow one person to tear down the organization, so we had to do something." In other words, he violated our cover-up, and our cover-up is company policy. Anybody who thinks that the primary focus of any NFL franchise is the health of the pieces of meat it throws on the field is 5 years old or not paying attention.
And that, in fact, was Kellen Winslow's characterization of the Browns. They treat us like pieces of meat.
Exactly. And if the league doesn't do something about this, then Roger Goodell's new sheriff persona is an empty suit as well.
Charlie, the good news for the New England Patriots this week was that they won big on Monday night with quarterback Tom Brady's replacement. The bad news is that Tom Brady's recovery from knee surgery has not gone as smoothly as it might have gone. What's going on there?
Well, he's had two more procedures to clear up some sort of infection he had as a result of his first operation. This is not a good thing. And it's not the New England Patriots are closed mouth about sprained ankles, so you can imagine how deeply they're trying to bury this one. You've got doctors chiming in who haven't seen the case file. You've got friends of the doctor who performed the operation chiming in saying that nothing could have gone wrong. Meanwhile, you've got a quarterback, probably the most important player in the league, whose recovery time is pushed back at least 2 months, I would think.
Troy Polamalu, who last week referred to pro football as, quote, a pansy game because of new rules designed to protect players, will play this weekend despite having suffered his seventh concussion last week against the Giants. Is that a rational decision on his part?
Well,
What a rhetorical question.
I think while there are birds flying and singing around Troy's head, he's not talking to them yet, so that means he can play in the NFL. Troy Polamalu should be done for the year. And the NFL should sit him down for the year. And if he complains, the NFL should fine him $25,000 a day until he shuts up.
How confident do you suppose the members of the Seattle Seahawks are feeling this week? Their coach having compared them to the team at Sacred Heart High School that he once coached.
Well, he's got no receivers left. He's on his fourth or ninth or 23rd quarterback of the year. Mike Holmgren probably is insulting the high school, to be perfectly honest with you, when he compares them to the Seahawks.
Okay, let's see if we can get this straight. The man formerly known as Chad Johnson, Chad Ochocinco, will stick with his former jersey, which reads Johnson on the back and not Ochocinco. Why is that?
Stupid politics, says Ochocinco/Johnson. I guess he's just decided this is not a fight worth taking on with the league. You know, with all the problems they have, let the guy be Ochocinco. Let the guy be Louis the Simple or Trigger if he wants to be. Who cares?
There's a big NFL game tomorrow in London, of all places, which will host San Diego and New Orleans. Do you figure the Saints are thrilled to be in the old city?
Well, I don't know that either team is thrilled to be there. With any luck, the weather will be better than last year. But the Saints may actually need to get away from it all. They're not having the kind of season they thought they were going to have, and this is the kind of thing that can turn it around.
Charlie, Major League Baseball may be worried that nobody's watching the World Series since it's rolling on despite the absence of the Red Sox, the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Mets, the Cubs, or any other major market team. But I assume that you're paying this spectacle some attention, this Rays versus Phils thing we've got going on.
Well, I'm paying it enough attention to know that, number one, Scott Kazmir continues his transformation into the greatest piece of trade bait of the last 20 years, and also that on Thursday night, we saw what is possibly the worst ball strike call I have ever seen in a Major League Baseball game. First of all, the pitch was a strike. Second of all, the guy swung. Third of all, they got everything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Rocco Baldelli should send that umpire a nice fruit basket for Christmas.
Jose Canseco said this week that he never realized that naming players who he says used steroids, quote, would hurt so many people. What do you suppose he did think the result of naming names would be?
Well, you know, presuming that he thinks, number one, which is always a long shot with Jose, this is now, oh my God, I may have cleared the pitch for me anywhere in baseball for the rest of my life. I'm really sorry. Now that I've cashed the last check on the book, I'm really sorry about it, gang.
The two-day festival of 14 horse races, known as the Breeders' Cup, will conclude today. The climax of the weekend will be the Breeders' Cup Classic, of course. Are you, like most handicappers, going with the favorite, Curlin?
Well, it's hard to argue with Curlin now that Big Brown isn't running against him. I am a little bit intrigued by the number four horse who went off early line at 10-1 called Duke of Marmalade.
Okay.
I haven't had a chance to look at the pedigree, but I'd love to know exactly what his grandparents' names were that produced the Duke of Marmalade. I mean, isn't that like you know, being the king of the Big Rock Candy Mountain or something?
That sounds great. The only thing is, I hope that the guy calling the race has a sense of humor, and if the horse is no good, he says, he looks like he's running in marmalade. Tiger Woods was on the golf course on Monday as a caddy. Perhaps you can explain that curious circumstance. And then tell me how well you think you'd play with Tiger Woods carrying your clubs.
Well, I just have this horrible, I have this horrible vision of you know, swinging the club and sort of hitting a decent shot and just hearing from behind you. I think Tiger could screw people up pretty badly.
Yeah.
You know, it's again, though, it's another one of this ongoing thing where he's making himself this kind of affable figure. I think he's going to wind up being not in Byron Nelson, 90 years old, wandering the course, shaking people's hands.
And finally, in our ongoing attempt to celebrate people who understand that records are made to be broken, we would like to celebrate the folks in Iran who shattered the record for world's largest sandwich, but I guess we can't do that.
People saw the 5,000-foot-long sandwich that took 1,500 cooks 2 days to make and contained 2,000 pounds of ostrich meat, and they couldn't help themselves, Bill. They started to eat it. Now, I think, given the plague of people trying to get in the Guinness Book of World Records, having hungry mobs start eating people or things trying to get into the Guinness Book of World Records is a wonderful trend that I think we here at Only a Game should encourage.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. This weekend, dozens of athletes will meet in a world championship that pits amateur against professional, brother against brother, Batman against Robin. Only a Game's Karen Given was at last year's Crazy Golf World Championship in Hastings, England, and she has our report.
Hastings is a seaside town on the southern coast of England, home to the first Norman castle built by William the Conqueror after the invasion of 1066. On summer weekends, crowds comb the beach and enjoy the amusement park rides and arcade. But one weekend a year, all eyes are on the golf course.
Yeah, if we can have all the players down here, please, in front of the windmill, we're going to have to squash you up a bit.
Nearly 80 golfers have arrived for the fifth annual World Crazy Golf Championships at the Hastings Adventure Golf Complex. At stake is £3,000 in prize money and considerable bragging rights. All the big names are here, including a 13-year-old mini-golf phenom from the Czech Republic and several members of the British national mini-golf team. Yes, there's a British national team, a tour of money-rich tournaments, and at least two international governing bodies for mini-golf, facts which tournament director David Hartley thinks should be well known to any sports reporter from the United States.
Well, shame on you, because one of the major events in the sporting calendar is the U.S. Masters.
There is a U.S. Masters.
Yes, there's a miniature golf equivalent of the Augusta Masters, yes.
Is it in Augusta?
No, I'm not quite sure where it is, to be honest with you. I'd have to go and do some homework on that.
For the record, the U.S. Masters is always held in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, during the fourth week of September. And the most recent winner was Brad Lebo from Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. But that's another story.
So we're going to start with players who are playing on the mini golf. The mini golf, that's the one with the flags behind me.
Hartley sends groups of players to the two courses used in this weekend's tournament. The mini golf course, as the name suggests, is very similar to a full-sized golf course, but in miniature. The crazy golf course is just a little crazier, with a windmill, inconveniently placed lighthouse, and various metal chutes and ramps. Each course has 18 holes, giving players 108 tries at an ace or a hole-in-one before the final round.
The scores are cumulative. So nobody is suddenly out. They can have a bad round and still survive. They can have a really good round and they're not necessarily in the lead. So after six rounds, then we look at the scores and the best 18 players go through to the final on Sunday afternoon.
Today's weather is cold and windy, but mostly dry. Tomorrow's finals are another story. The forecast calls for cold, stinging rain and heavy winds. Hartley isn't concerned.
Never rains in Hastings. This is paradise here, and it never rains. But should it, it doesn't matter. We continue. There's only two things that will stop us playing here. Either there's so much snow on the ground you can't see where the course is, or thunder and lightning. That aside, it can blow what it likes, it can rain as much as it likes, we carry on. We're British.
With a loud horn, the first round of the day is set into motion. As a dozen reporters and photographers look on, dimpled white balls are coaxed around hazards, over ramps, and through a large metal chute. Most of the competitors use standard mini-golf putters with padded heads. A few have custom equipment embellished with flames or other decorations, but Phil Botto's putter is one of a kind. Botto's putter began its life as a camera tripod. Last year, Botto played with a stick he found on the ground and did okay, but the tripod isn't working quite so well.
But it bends because it's aluminium, so it's a bit of a nightmare, really. It doesn't help.
Oh, you can adjust it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It goes whichever size I want. It doesn't help, but it makes me think it helps. You know, it's all in the mind.
Botto's happy to have fun and embrace the crazy in crazy golf. But on the other side of the course, there's one competitor who doesn't even sound happy when he gets a hole-in-one.
Come on.
A quick glance at this gentleman's scorecard shows that he's well in contention for the top prize. So why is he so glum?
I'm Tim Aceman Davis, four-time World Crazy Golf Champion, and expecting a lot more than this, which is 10th or worse at the moment. You know, I played three aces and got three threes, whereas I should be playing all twos and the rest should be aces.
So, I'll come back.
Oh!
As he watches another putt just miss the hole, Davis groans and mutters, "Oh, what a cruel world this is." Part of the drama is for show, of course. As the four-time world champion and Britain's number one player, Davis is the closest thing crazy golf has to a celebrity. But most people are unaware of his accomplishments.
Well, I don't go out and tell them, generally. I wait for them to find out. And their response is, "Oh, didn't know there was one." Or, you know, some people have said that's really sad, and you think, well, why don't you do something with your life? And what it's led to, in fact, is me becoming an author. And so I've written a book with my friend Big Top Ted. We've made a Crazy Golf instructional DVD, which is fun. You know, so it's all come from this wonderful game.
Keith Kellard is another mini golfer in Britain's top 10. He's wearing the crisp blue and white jacket of the British national team, but he says making it as a mini golfer can be a struggle.
In order to break even, you have to finish in, you know, the top 4 or 5 or so to actually take a couple of £100 to actually pay for the petrol, pay for the accommodation, pay for everything. Yeah, it can, you know, the money can rack up, and yeah, if you don't win a few tournaments or don't get in on the podium, then your bank balance can be hit.
Like all of today's contenders, Kellard has spent countless hours and course fees diagramming every hole from every angle. In his thick, dog-eared notebook, a small G indicates he should play the hole straight, big L means aim for the far left lip, and 3 R's suggests he should hit from 3 inches to the right. Over the past week, Kellard has plotted notes for every hole on the course, but by next week, they'll all be useless.
Children come along and club on the course, big dent in there on your line, and it makes a big difference. Sometimes they recarpet them, and sometimes they just completely change the hole. So, yeah, every year you're coming back and you're checking your notes and you're remaking notes. And if you're using a notebook from 3-4 years ago, you have crossings out and changes.
Paul Rye isn't carrying a notebook. There's no place to put one on the utility belt of his deluxe Batman costume, complete with mask, cape, and molded foam muscles. Batman and Robin, the appropriately dressed Gordon Ingalls, have been getting a lot of attention from the media today. But is their golf similarly eye-catching?
Yeah, we're number one. We're number one, mate. Me and my friend Robin. Yeah.
I think Batman's pulling your leg a bit. I'm certainly not very good. I'm not particularly good at crazy golf.
64th and 70th at the moment, aren't we? That's where we're lying.
I'm quite low in the field at the moment. But it was more for fun for us than for serious competition.
I'm not a big fan of it, to be honest. I think it devalues this sport.
Carlos Martinez and his friend Paul Whitehouse are dressed in knickers, argyle socks, and tweed golf caps, and they're not amused by a couple of high-quality Halloween costumes.
They rock up together, dressed as Batman and Robin, but then they get split up, so you might turn up as Batman and Robin, but after a couple of minutes, you're basically just a bloke in a Batman suit playing golf. So,
if you're going to be a superhero who works on his own, like the Hulk.
Superman,
yeah.
Spider-Man, that sort of thing.
Martinez and Whitehouse finished the 2007 event in 35th and 33rd places, respectively, well ahead of Batman and Robin. Tim, the Ace Man Davis, saw his string of bad luck continue. He finished out of the mix in 11th place. Davis will attempt to reclaim his former title today in Hastings. British national team member Chris Harding will try for two in a row. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We saw them coming four holes away, and we all knew it was you. Those tubes of polyester on your legs, they're all red and green and yellow and blue. You'd need a metal detector to prove it. Man, I swear they're 88. Where did you get those pants? Where did you get those pants?
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Erica Bailey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Crazy Golf Photo Gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from crazy golfers Paul Whitehouse and Carlos Martinez.
Carlos and I are both purists, really. You go out there, it's just you and a club and a ball and a hole. No nose.
Against the elements.
It's about time someone in the crazy golf world stood up against the note takers, the superhero costume robe wearers, the stick wielders, in short, the impure. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Where did you get those pants? Where did you get those pants? Where did you get those pants?
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.